Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Good afternoon. Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, coming to you live from Biden Field this afternoon in Fresno. Yep, doing double duty today. It's a doubleheader of baseball between Oregon and Fresno State coming up at 2, so we'll get to the baseball pregame show at 1:45. But between now and then, I get to do what I get to do every Saturday afternoon and get great enjoyment out of doing so. That's visit with World War II veterans. Call this show Hometown Heroes because it's my belief that no matter where you go in this great country of ours, there's a hero in your hometown, and you probably just don't know it. And when I say a hero, I just mean someone who is willing to put his or her life on the line for ours and for the freedom that we enjoy in this country today, the freedom I have today to come out and watch a couple baseball games on a Saturday afternoon. And I've gotten so many suggestions from all of you listeners over the years, and I try to get to them as quickly as I can. And one suggestion I got from a listener in Fresno was to talk to his father up in Fortuna. So that's what I'll do today. For those of you who don't know, Fortuna is up near Eureka on the Northern California coast. And that's where we find a gentleman who loved flying so much that if it weren't for the insurance companies telling him he couldn't fly anymore, he'd still be doing it at age 92. And Lee Whitehead is our guest today. Lee, I understand your last trip in the cockpit was, what, about 2 years ago on your 90th birthday? Is that right?
Well, it was May 24th, 2008.
And you brought it down safely, right?
Well, heck, why not? I live in it.
Now, and I, talking to you a little bit before the show, one thing that really struck me was what you said about getting into the service. And we're going to talk a lot about flying, and people probably think you're an Army Air Corps veteran of World War II, but that's not the case. Anchors Away is your tune. And I like the statement that you made to me about being a millionaire. Tell our listeners what you told me about the day that you joined the Navy.
Well, when I joined the Navy, all I looked at was a fleet of beautiful airplanes. So I was a millionaire the day I walked in, but I had no money in my pocket. You had to be a multimillionaire to operate the way we were operating in the Navy.
So it was quite the thrill for you to get a chance to work with some of that incredible, at that time, incredible technology.
You better believe it.
Now let's talk about this. You're 92 now. You'll be 93 in a couple months.
In May.
In May. And so you are one of, as far as the World War II veterans who survived today, you're part of the older bunch of that, and you were actually in the service before Pearl Harbor. When did you end up in the Navy and why?
Well, I thought I would be drafted along the line sometime, and I wanted to select the part of the service that I want to serve in. So in January of 1940, I applied to the Navy and was accepted, and I went through E-Base at Long Beach, California. And that was in January of 40. In March, I reported at Pensacola and went through their flight program.
So when you joined the Navy, was your interest in flying? Is that something you thought was going to be possible the day that you signed up?
Hey, I fell in love with an airplane when I was 6 years old. I lived across the street from an airport as a boy. And I got my rump paddled many times. We would be eating dinner in a strange airplane and land, I'm gone.
Well, and you know, you talk about that. You're born in 1917, so when you're 6 years old, airplanes hadn't been around that long. This is still a pretty newfangled idea that I can see why it would be completely fascinating for a young boy.
Well, the thing is, in my eyes, it's the greatest thing God let us have.
Well, that's why you spent so much time in the air over the last close to a century. You're going to be 93 in May, and a lot of those years have been spent around airplanes. I'm curious, and I start here with a lot of veterans. You were in before Pearl Harbor, almost 2 years before the attacks on December 7th, 1941. But where were you that day on December 7th? And already being in the Navy, maybe that impacted you a little differently than those who hadn't joined the service yet. What do you remember about that Sunday morning, December 7th, 1941?
Well, I was an instructor at Pensacola, Florida, primary on Corey Field. And we were notified, or it came over the radio, that Pearl Harbor was attacked.
Did that have an impact on you right away? Was that something that you knew things were going to change in your life and all the guys around you's lives?
Well, I never even thought of it that way. All I knew, I was in love with airplanes, and here I am playing with them.
Well, and you'd get 55 missions to play with them during World War II. And, you know, I've had a lot of pilots on this show and in my television work over the years and interviewing World War II veterans. And we've talked to guys who have flown every plane you can think of, B-24s and B-17s and P-38s and P-51s and anything you throw out there, Army, Navy, whatever. And I don't know if I've ever had a PV-1 pilot on the show before, but that's what you were during the war. And for our listeners who have never heard of a PV-1 Ventura before, why don't you explain what that aircraft is and what it's all about?
Well, it was a patrol bomber, land-based. You see, when we went out on submarine patrol, airplanes like the PBY was a good airplane to do patrol work at night.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's when a German sub would resurface and charge your batteries.
And the PBYs could take off and land on water, but you were a land-based plane.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
They were preferably like a night patrol plane. All right, the land patrol planes we had in the Navy were PV-1 Venturas and B-24s, which we call privateers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I wasn't interested in those, and the Navy put me in the Ventura. I was a primary in-flight instructor for the first 20 months of the war. Then they transferred me over to the BB-2 training, which was flying the Ventura. And I flew that for 19 months until the war ended, when they detached me, like it was VE Day, till I was in for a reassignment at Lake City, Florida. I was getting ready to go to the Pacific, flying Harpoons, which was the...
That's the PV-2 with the...
That's the baby, and she wasn't as good as the PV-1.
They redesigned the Ventura, then called it the PV-2 Harpoon, and was it not as maneuverable? Is that what you didn't like about it?
It was too slow.
Uh-huh.
And it wasn't as maneuverable. That PV-1 was like flying a P-38. It was a fighter plane.
Well, let's talk about some of these missions that you flew. And you're in the Atlantic, and during this time, midway through World War II, and even in the first half of the Long War in the Atlantic, the German U-boats were still a menacing presence. And your crews, those PV-1s, were assigned to try to prevent the U-boats from attacking U.S. convoys. What was a typical mission like? I know you flew 55 of them, and some of them were different than others. But can you give us a taste of what those missions were like, how long they were, what it was like inside the plane, what you were looking for, and what you did?
Well, I'll start, like, say, when we were up at Floyd Bennett Field in New York.
Uh-huh.
That's where we started patrol work. And what we would do, we would get an assignment that there's a convoy, either British or one of ours, going one way or the other, coming over here, or Brits come over here to get stuff to take home, and we form convoys to take stuff over to Europe. Well, the ships would be out there in a big box, like a big rectangle.
Mm-hmm.
And they would be half a mile apart in line, and then there'd be a row of them behind them, and so on. And what the German subs would do, if they had a chance, they wouldn't fire torpedoes. They'd surface and use their deck guns on them.
Mm-hmm.
Hell, they were like tin cans. They punch a couple of holes in them, and they're gone. just a matter of time. Well, what we had to do is to keep those German subs submerged because they couldn't go, even though a convoy was moving along at about 7 knots, a German sub would have to surface in order to get into position. Well, if he had to stay submerged, they just went on by. Well, that's what we tried to do. But if we caught one on the surface, we had 6 depth charges, 325-pounders, and we had a intervalometer in our airplane. What that did is when we could select how to drop, we would drop a string of bombs 60 feet apart.
Mm-hmm.
And we would come in on a convoy, and we had to fly a pattern around that convoy. We had a formula. I don't remember that details of what that formula was, but we would come up with a pattern to fly around the convoy that we would have a radar on all sections of that thing in one circle of it.
Mm-hmm.
And if we spotted a submarine, its firewall, the throttles and the props, and put that airplane in a dive, it could really hustle its way down the hill. 326 knots was its red line, and I'd be right there.
And you're feeling a few G's when you're doing that, I'm sure, taking a dive like that. You didn't have, if you did spot a sub, you probably didn't have much time to get rid of those depth charges to have a shot at getting that sub. How much time would you say you had once you spotted one?
If you spotted one, what you had to do is, when you're in your dive, is to look for the periscope, which when he gets down to that depth, it left a little feather when it disappeared. Well, you had 19 seconds from the time that feather disappeared to get your bombs off.
So the periscope, when it resubmerged, would leave a feather-shaped wake in the water. And once that feather was no longer, you had 19 seconds to drop the bombs.
That's right.
All right.
And then over 19 seconds, you could drop half your load up to 45 seconds. And if it was beyond 45 seconds, you see, they would try to trick us to drop our bombs. Then they could surface and fire their depth guns instead of firing torpedoes.
Now, I imagine most of the time that you spent flying for those 55 missions, you were waiting to see something and didn't see anything, and it could probably become fairly monotonous. And is that the case? And if so, what did you do to keep your attention up and stay awake and stay focused?
Well, you just had to stay awake because they interrogated you when you came in, and you had to report what you did.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the missions would be like maybe from time of takeoff to landing could be up about 5-6 hours at the very most.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was the airplane had 13 possible gas tanks in it. Now, you see, the poor pilot, he had to be a flight engineer managing the fuel system, plus navigating, plus sending radio messages in, and flying the airplane, and using your binoculars, 7x50s, which we had to scan the ocean, and we had a 5 members in the crew, and when we got out where the position was, where the convoy was, well, everybody was on a lookout station. Pilot, co-pilot, the mech, the radio man, he would be on the radio, of course. He couldn't look out. And the gunner, who was in the top deck turret, and the mech would take the waist gun in case you had to make an attack.
Mm-hmm.
Because this airplane had 550 calibers right at my feet, right in front of me. And it had 250 calibers in the top deck turret. And we had a waist gunner position, which was toward the tail section of the airplane. It had twin 30s in it.
So you guys were loaded for bear and just...
You better believe it was an attack aircraft.
But and like many wildlife hunters today, you spent a lot of time waiting for the catch that never came, huh?
Well, that's just about it. But we never lost a ship, and that's what's important.
Well, I was going to ask you that because I've interviewed a few blimp pilots from World War II, and as you know, the blimps were heavily involved as well in trying to protect convoys from submarine attacks at the hands of the Germans or even the Japanese in some instances. And they're very proud of their record of protecting convoys. So in all those missions you flew, 55 missions, none of the ships were ever hit?
That's right. We, the whole squadron, while I was in it, we never lost a ship. Every one of them got through as our areas. I don't know what happened to them after we left them, because you see the Atlantic Ocean, we're flying off the coast, and they get out, well, like say we took them out 300 or 400 miles in the privateers, the B-24s took them for a while, then they had the Jeep carriers out in the center. And then when they get on the other side, it was all in reverse.
Right.
Until they landed into Europe.
And before the show's over, I'm going to ask you about some of your close calls. But while we're on this topic of escorting convoys and protecting ships from submarine attacks, the different kinds of ships that you're escorting were different. I mean, sometimes you're protecting troop ships. Sometimes I know you spent a good deal of time flying further south in the Atlantic and down off the coast of South America, protecting the oil tankers, right? And that was clearly a vital part of the war effort for the Americans. If you don't have the oil supplies, it's going to be hard to run any of the equipment on the ground or in the air. Tell me what you remember about that and the oil refineries in Curacao that you protected.
Well, when we were in Curacao, the oil was coming out of Colombia to the Shell oil refineries there at Willemstad. Well, the German subs would try to get at them, so we would keep them in the underwater the same way as we did in the Atlantic. We never lost any ships there. No, what was interesting, though, just before Curacao, our headquarters were on San Juan, Puerto Rico. Well, we went down to Trinidad, which is an island.
Right.
And from there, we deployed a section of our group down to Zandri in Dutch Guiana. Well, while in Dutch Guiana, that's where we were flying down into the South Atlantic.
Right.
And you know, when you were reading about this Air France airliner that flew into a thunderstorm there and it disintegrated in the air?
Right.
I still can't get an answer for that, because we would fly around those babies. We wouldn't monkey with them.
That same area?
Storms went up to 60,000 feet.
So you saw some pretty wild storms like that when you flew in that area.
Oh, yeah. We lost one airplane there. The crew bailed out of it. And we got them all back. But, you know, the interesting thing about that part is when we got them all back, and now we try to settle some kind of thing. It was the bush in the jungles got our crew, Well, what would you think they wanted?
Well, I don't know, but I'll tell you what. Why don't we take a quick break, and we can answer that when we come back for the second half of Hometown Heroes this afternoon. We need to get some commercials in, but Lee, if you'll hold right there, I will get the rest of the show going as soon as we take this quick break. Hometown Heroes today on News Talk 580, KMJ. Away for our guest today, a Navy veteran of World War II, Lee Whitehead. He'll be 93 in May, and if he could get insurance to fly an airplane, if they would certify him at his age, he'd still be flying. He last was in the cockpit at age 90. He was a lot younger than that in World War II when he was flying PV-1 Venturas with Patrol Squadron 147 in the Atlantic Ocean. When we left off, he was telling us about a plane in his squadron where the men aboard, the five-man crew, had to bail out, and they were held captive for a while by some natives, Lee. And as we finish up the program, we've got another 15 minutes or so. I know that we're going to hear about some intense experiences that you had in the cockpit, some close calls, and all that I ask is that we keep it clean for our radio audience, and I know that you'll do that. But why don't you start by telling us what it was those natives down on the eastern coast of South America wanted from the Navy men before they let them go?
Well, they didn't actually keep them as prisoners. Hell, they gave them everything they had. But what the natives wanted was spark plugs for their outboard motors and salt. S-A-L-T.
Uh-huh.
That's all they wanted.
Those were the big commodities for them.
Yeah, that's what really threw a, you know, it made you have a laugh. God, people would have thinking it'd be money. Well, they don't live with money down there.
Money would do them no good.
That's right.
Boy, you get a lot of perspective, and I'm sure that your whole Navy experience opened your eyes a little bit. Now, I want to ask you specifically about some of your missions. I understand, is it true that the very first mission you flew, you were in a blizzard where you couldn't even see the wingtips of that PV-1?
You better believe it. I flew off of Floyd Bennett Field in New York, and they gave me, and it's hard to understand, they had these high-level winds where it would be 70 knots on my tail.
Whew.
Going out. Well, I was below that, so it diminished as I came down. But here it is in the month of February, and I had never flown a patrol in my life. We were up there at Floyd Bennett as a squadron, because we were going to be at a school up at Quonset Point, Rhode Island.
Uh-huh.
And there was some units already there. Well, in the meantime, they put us on active duty flying patrols.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, surprise, surprise is right. Well, I took off. Now, this is in the twilight area, and I flew and I came back in. Oh, it was from about 6 o'clock in the evening to about 11 o'clock at night. But what I was getting at, when I took off, here I am flying along, the radar going. I think we were looking for a British convoy, which we could never find. Those guys are on rum rations too much.
They're not here to defend themselves, but I'm sure the snow, the blizzard, didn't help you find anything.
Well, all I did is sit there and run radar blips from one to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next. Heck, I couldn't see nothing. It was snowing so bad.
Were you at all scared and worried that you wouldn't be able to find your way back or land in one piece?
Oh, heck. I'll tell you the way that coastline is, the East Coast is the line running north and south. And you take the Long Island there, and you look at the south southeast coastline of that, it made a triangle.
Right.
See, you had an angle in there. If I'm flying west and I hit the coastline, turn right.
Gotcha.
If I'm flying and I hit that angle coast, turn left. And where the two lines met was Floyd Bennett Field. Heck, I didn't need anything but just...
Just natural instinct.
Well, just to be able to see a little bit.
Uh-huh.
Well, anyway... When the time come home, you see, I don't like to tell on anybody. I don't want to mention any names, but my co-pilot was so scared, he just turned white shortly after takeoff. Oh, we hit the snowstorm. I was flying alone, but the rest of the crew was doing their job.
Right.
Well, here we are flying home. Flying home, and I had written a in report with my estimated time of arrival, and I gave it to my radioman, and I asked him, I said, please don't send this until I tell you.
Right.
Don't use my time estimate. Well, I'm flying in, and I was listening on the radio, and I couldn't pick anything up because my antennas, even in the snowstorm, had iced up.
Ah.
And I couldn't pick up nothing. Well, I was boring along and just waiting, and pretty soon I hear, I believe it was either Mitchell or, which was on Long Island, or Newark radio over on the coast of the U.S. there.
Right, the Jersey coast.
I was looking for the intersection where these two beams, heck, and then I'd get a position report exactly where I am. Well, about the time I was approaching, my radioman, he gets on the air and sent my in report. Which I asked him not to do until I told him. Well, he's a little hot-headed Irishman. So I turned around him and I said something to him. I said, hey, Murray, please get off the air. Send him an AS. I'm starting to pick up some signals and I want to try to hit this fix. Well, what does that sucker do but turn all my radios off? It's CW radio. Well, the base thought I went into the drink. Yeah.
And all this was your first mission.
Yeah.
So they were very surprised to see you land on the runway.
Well, anyway, as we left, the storm had passed, and I was getting into the trail end of it, and hell, here I could see the lights of New York. I come in and landed, and who was there to meet me but the skipper of the squadron and the wing aircraft commander. Well, what the Navy had done is turn all the lights on the Navy bases around the area to get me in.
Huh.
So I could see. Well, when I landed, the skipper... All he said to me is, I want to see you in my office 9 o'clock in the morning.
Uh-oh.
Yes, sir. Well, I trotted my little fanny up there at 9 o'clock the next day, and he says, well, I got to ground you. Well, I was a patrol plane commander designation at that time, so he grounded me. He says, well, you'll have the first flight and the last flight every day. Well, I started to laugh inside. I said, I joined the Navy to fly airplanes, and here my punishment is to play with those beautiful toys.
Your punishment was to fly more than you would have otherwise.
Well, right.
Not a bad punishment.
So anyway,
at all.
I flew for, he grounded me for 2 weeks. And what he did after 1 week, he said, oh, you got your designation back. And I went back and that was it. But what got me, I think he thought I may have lied to him about my antennas freezing up. Well, later on in the war, our executive officer run into a problem with icing. He said something at the bar with some of the guys. He never told me, which I felt a little hurt when I found out about it. He says, now I know what Whitehead was talking about.
They thought you were making up a story about the frozen antenna, and then they knew firsthand that it was true. Lee Whitehead is our guest today. He's 92 years old, lives up in Fortuna on the Northern California coast. Lee, we have about 5 minutes left in the program. I hope I don't have to cut you off at any point here. But I understand that after the war, you got to know a little bit, a figure from the war who I think everyone in our audience will recognize, General Jimmy Doolittle. What was it like to meet him and get to know him a little bit, and how'd that happen?
Well, I didn't. Well, my son, he is a duck hunter.
Right.
All right. When he was in high school, I bought him a Jeep to keep him out of the dope gangs.
And I'm sure he thanks you for that every day.
And he used to drive up to a duck club, which was across the street from Edwards Air Force Base.
Uh-huh.
And Jimmy Doolittle used to come up there, and my son would take him around in the Jeep. Well, I don't remember exactly the details how this came about, but I was in the Condor Squadron at Van Nuys at that time.
Flying air shows all over the place, right?
Yep, flying air shows, and they wanted me to go up there and buzz Jimmy Doolittle that was at the duck club. So I come up there with, I don't remember, with 6 or 9 of the T-6s. I put them in red echelon and peeled off, and down we came. Well, I buzzed them. Then when I got back up to Van Nuys, I drove over there, and I had dinner with Jimmy Doolittle and the rest of the guys at the club.
Was that a significant thing for you? Because so much, I'm sure, you heard during the war, and his mission to Tokyo was so inspirational for the American war effort. Was that a big deal for you to get to meet him and talk to him a little bit?
Oh, yes. Well, the thing, it was good. Hell, I followed him ever since I was a little boy. I used to read about him. He was one of my idols.
Even before the war, when he was racing and stuff like that?
Heck, yes.
Uh-huh.
Hell, he used to be... Hell, I met Lindbergh. Hell, I actually talked to Lindbergh a couple of times. Hell, I used to go over to Vail Field where Western Airline got started.
Uh-huh.
I was over there one day when Lindy landed. He got out of his airplane, and I don't know, the photographers, it was really funny. They were all around with their tripods set up, getting ready to snap his picture, and every time they would come out and take a look at Lindy, they wanted him to turn and smile, and so they could click off their camera, he'd turn 180 degrees. So Lindy, those photographers would knock us kids out of the way and get all set up again. Lindy would do the same thing.
Well, it's neat that you got to meet some of your heroes in aviation, and I can tell, I know our listeners can, how much you love airplanes. Just a little more than a minute left in the show here. The question that is in my mind is there anything in the world that you love more than airplanes?
Well, I still think it was the greatest thing God ever let us have, even to this day. One man takes off. One man brings it back. If you follow me, you get...
I do.
Yep.
And I know you had the chance to do that many, many times, and clearly those memories are still etched in your brain and will be for a long time. Lee, I'm sorry that we've run out of time here, but thanks so much for joining us today and sharing some of your stories. Thank you for serving our country when we needed you, and for having such a love for your country and for airplanes and the willingness to talk about it today.
Well, that's okay.
All right. That's better than okay. Thank you very much, Lee. Have a great day. That is Lee Whitehead, 92 years old, soon to be 93, of Fortuna in Northern California. I want to thank his son, Dan, here in Fresno, for letting me know about Lee. I'm sure there's much that we didn't get to cover today, but maybe you'll look Lee up and get those stories for yourself. We're out of time on Hometown Heroes. Bulldog Baseball is coming up next. The pregame show starts in about 10 seconds. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ and KMJNow.com.